Hello. I will call the meeting of the Local Government Division to order. Today is March 2nd, 2022. This meeting is being held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for a remote hearing. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by the House Public Information. And next, Josh, would you take the roll, please?
Good morning, Representative Mason.
Good morning.
Representative Elkins.
Elkins, present.
Representative Kwan.
Present.
Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Mecklen.
Present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Joachim.
Present.
All members are present.
Thank you so much. Today, we're going to be having continued discussion on House File 3256, Representative Elkins' bill. We did run out of time last time, and I just want to thank everyone that is testifying today that had to come back. Again, thank you very much for doing so. And we will start with Paul Ager, who from Minnesota Realtors, who was the last person, and I had to cut him off, and I apologize for that. Proceed. Identify yourself and proceed, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Paul Ager, and I'm Senior Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. And Madam Chair, thank you very much for the invitation to come back this morning and complete my testimony. And I assure you and the committee members, I will not repeat what I said last week. So this will be brief testimony today. But thank you very much for allowing me to finish my testimony. In my testimony last week, I did share some market data that demonstrated the lack of housing available on the market and the importance of the discussion that Representative Elkins has started with House File 3256 to try to remove some barriers to the development of new housing, particularly starter homes. However, there are also a few items in the bill which we oppose, and I'll finish up my testimony from last week by touching briefly on those items this morning. We do oppose the impact fees in the street improvement districts in Articles 1 and 2, which would increase the cost of housing and further reduce affordability. These are issues that we addressed in testimony last session, and we joined other organizations with concerns about those provisions on handouts that you have in your packet. We also oppose the energy cost disclosure requirement language in Article 10, Section 1. We do not need another mandate on the real estate transaction. I have shared with Representative Elkins that we are happy to participate in discussions with the utilities about whether opportunities exist for making energy cost information more easily accessible to interested buyers. We oppose making it a blanket requirement in every real estate transaction without regard to whether the buyer would find that information useful. Finally, I would like to thank Representative Elkins again for his work on the critical issues of housing supply and affordability. We look forward to working with him and stakeholders on all sides of this issue, from builders to local governments and others as this discussion continues. And thank you again, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to complete my testimony this morning. Appreciate it.
You are welcome, and thank you.
Madam Chair? Yes, Representative Elkins, sorry.
Madam Chair, you're muted.
Sorry, Representative Elkins?
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to let the committee know that I've heard Mr. Eggers about the energy provision, and I've decided that I'm going to break the energy disclosure provision into a separate bill. It doesn't need to be part of this bill. I realize that it also would require the bill to stop in energy and commerce. So I'm going to break this out into a separate bill, and I'm continuing to work with both the realtors and the utilities and other stakeholders on developing that bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I do want to mention to everyone that's here that if you want there is written testimony, agenda, the rest of the documents. If you go to our website, the Local Government Division, You will find those documents there. Next, Lisa Barajas. If you would identify yourself and proceed, please.
Thank you.
And I apologize if I said your name wrong.
That's quite all right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. I know it's not a typical Minnesota name. And that's why I'll introduce myself. Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Lisa Barajas, the Executive Director of Community Development at the Metropolitan Council. And I really appreciate the opportunity this morning. First, I really would like to thank Representative Elkins for all of the time and conversation that we've had so far on his proposed bill. I really appreciate the thought and consideration he has given to this matter. And we can agree that there is a need to support and further the production of affordable housing in this region. That's something that the Metropolitan Council has been banging the drum on probably for like the last 15 years or so. And it's definitely a sticky wicket that we keep working on and trying to find all the ways about moving production overall in the region as well as affordable housing production in the region. Today, I only speak to the proposed provisions that directly interact with the council. We have shared with Representative Elkins our support for the provisions in Article 12 that repeal special session laws applying to Oak Grove and Now Them for their comprehensive plans. And for those of you who are new or were not around in that during the time of passage, at that time, the council opposed the passage of those bills because they allowed for exceptions to the regional planning process without broad engagement, analysis, and public conversation that is conducted as part of the regional planning process that the legislature directs us to conduct as part of the 10-year planning cycle in the 7-county area. Repealing those provisions will remove that exception and bring those two communities back in planning alignment, that coordination that we're directed to do with the other 186 communities in the 7-county region. There are a couple of articles that we continue to have concerns with and have shared those concerns with Representative Elkins as well. This includes some small provisions related to the relationship between planning and zoning and related to our livable communities programs outlined in Article 3. And I know Representative Elkins and I continue to converse on that, and I'm sure we'll land on some language there that we can, that both furthers both of our intents there, but also adds clarity for local governments who are responsible for implementing those laws. What I do want to share with today are some concerns we have, stronger concerns about Article 6 and 7, which we've also shared with Representative Elkins. They set minimum standards for planned residential densities and for sewer accessibility charges in the metro area. Now, we don't disagree with the intent, and we do find value in exploring those policy considerations, but just like with the exceptions for Now Then and Oak Grove that were passed previously, we find that policies really are best discussed, researched, and debated as part of the regional planning process in which all of the impacted metro communities and all other stakeholders can participate. That process will allow us to gather all those perspectives, explore the costs and trade-offs, and address unique and unusual circumstances across the region, and then develop those standards that further the council's legislative directive to plan for orderly and economical development of the region. Setting these standards in law kind of circumvents that process and has the potential for unforeseen negative consequences. We have to play a lot of catch-up to put those into place. But again, I'd like to thank the committee for your time today and thank Representative Elkins for his work on this bill. And I look forward to continuing to work with him on the provisions that I discussed today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next, we have Irene Kyle from Lake of Minnesota. Representative Elkins, yes, sir.
I just wanted to thank Ms. Barajas. I mean, I continue to be, you know, actively engaged with all of the stakeholders on this bill. But Ms. Barajas has been an incredible, you know, sounding board and contributor to the process. I just wanted to say how much I appreciate her assistance in navigating some of the complexities of this bill.
And next, Irene, if you would identify yourself, please, and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Irene Gao, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I wanted to start by thanking you and the committee for allowing us the additional opportunity today to hear from city perspectives on this, with this continued hearing on House File 3256. I also want to thank Representative Elkins for his many meetings with the League, city affiliates, individual cities on the important issues of housing and related zoning. This morning, as many of you know, the League of Minnesota Cities is a statewide organization, and it's that statewide nature that I want to focus on. Recently, cities have adopted a resolution that highlights three things. And I'm actually going to share my screen right now so you can see, hopefully, Madam Chair. Hopefully you're seeing the slide that has the cities that have adopted this resolution. Wonderful. So this resolution that cities adopted highlight three things. One, that zoning is best handled locally. And while previous testifiers, what they said is true, zoning authority comes from the state. Zoning is still done best locally because there are a number of different factors. Not only are housing issues and their needs different depending on where you are in the state, also the topography or maybe the relationship to different one of the many 10,000 lakes within the state that then have additional regulations and complicates the mandates within this bill. The second thing is that housing issues are different across the state. They are varied, and the solutions need to be varied too. Cities have done a number of different things to try to address their housing issues. Some cities have sold lots for as cheap as a dollar. They have tried to explore ways that they themselves could serve as developers, because unfortunately, builders and developers are not coming to some of the cities in our communities where there are growing economies and they need housing. Or there are other cities where the need is really around truly affordable housing and serving residents in our communities that have the lowest incomes, or possibly it's preserving our naturally occurring affordable housing. Whatever the needs are, they are different, and the solutions have to be different as well. The third thing that this resolution points out is that we do need a state and local partnership to address these issues. Housing is a statewide issue, and we have to be working together in order to have more housing across the entire state. Now, the last thing I wanted to point out with these resolutions is that you'll notice they are not only across the entire state, they also come from some of our smallest communities that are less than 1,000. So we're talking about cities like Amboy, Bird Island, Graceville. And they also come from some of our metro area cities as well, including some of our cities that are in the districts of the member of this of the members of this committee, including Rosemount, as well as Minnetonka and Eden Prairie. And so I will stop sharing. There are other things too. There are a number of different things where cities are outside of their control and need that statewide or as the partnership between the state and local governments. Things out of our control include things like the cost of labor, the cost of materials. Lumber has skyrocketed. Where the market is, that sometimes some of properties are selling for much more, even if there may be a subdivision of the identical house. It can be sometimes as great as $100,000 more, but the market is dictating that that is the price. Nevertheless, we need to work together to address these issues that are across our entire state that affect all of the cities within Minnesota. Now, Madam Chair, I know that there are a number of different city testifiers that are coming after me. I do want to make sure that they have time to discuss things. They will talk about some of the provisions that we both support, as well as some of the provisions that we can have concerns about. And they represent those from the metro, as well as greater Minnesota, and even some expertise from an engineering perspective. I will also be here for questions should any members have any. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Representative Elkins, did you have a comment right now?
No, I think I'll wait until the other city testifiers have testified, but I am going to have a number of questions for Ms. Gao at the end. But let's go through the other city testifiers.
Okay, sounds good. I see your hand up. I just wanted to check. All right, next we have Charles Vanderard. If you would identify yourself for the record and proceed, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Charlie Vanderardi for Metro Cities, which represents the collective interests of cities across the metropolitan region at the legislature, executive branch, and the Metropolitan Council. Thank you for the opportunity to come back and testify today. Metro Cities generally opposes House File 3256, specifically provisions in the bill that preempt local authority and decision-making on zoning and land uses. Many of the provisions in the bill specifically affect cities in the metropolitan area. The bill contains several amendments to Chapter 473, which guides regional and local processes that pertain to density, orderly growth in the region, and local comprehensive planning. Provisions in the bill would upend long-standing regional and local coordination and municipal planning authorities that allow for appropriate staging and funding of regional and local growth. The effects of the language in Article 3 would have the effect of privatizing planning and requiring premature and costly regional infrastructure outlays. It would take the public role of guiding land and managing local growth and infrastructure needs and costs and hand this role to private entities and developers. Additionally, making comp plans and fiscal devices completely consistent could create many non-conforming uses. The bill's proposed changes to density are inflexible. Metropolitan cities are currently required to meet minimum residential densities under regional level policies that allow cities to guide where higher density and lower housing density could be built. Unique local considerations such as topography, geologies, and infrastructure are considered. The current regional requirement of 8 or 12 affordable units per acre is focused on meeting affordable housing needs while also allowing cities to maintain local zoning and land use authorities. Metro City's policies strongly support state funding and sufficient local tools and resources that allow cities to meet local housing needs. House File 3256 would preempt local critical decision-making authority and potentially innovation with respect to land use indecisions and respectfully ask you to oppose the bill. Metro Cities appreciates the committee's consideration of our concerns over the bill's obstruction of existing metro-specific processes that ensure the orderly growth of the region and required regional infrastructure to serve this growth. Thank you today.
Thank you. Next, we have the mayor from Minnetonka. If you would identify yourself for the record and proceed, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Brad Wearsome, and I am mayor in the city of Minnetonka. I am testifying on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities. I am also the current past president of the League and am a past president of Metro Cities. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I also want to thank Representative Elkins for working with cities on this bill and for also demonstrating flexibility to modify the bill as he learns more. So we appreciate that. However, respectfully, we will oppose most of the bill. My other city colleagues will discuss Articles 1 and 2, and you will learn more about that later. I will focus my concerns and comments on the zoning preemption provisions. The bill is titled Legalizing Affordable Housing, but housing policy at the state level should do a number of things. It should address the full spectrum of housing. It should support innovation at the local level. It should focus on providing incentives and tools rather than mandates. And it should provide community-specific solutions throughout our state. Unfortunately, this bill does not do that. Instead, it focuses on zoning preemption. Allow me to share a few zoning basics. Zoning regulation is an important planning tool that benefits communities economically and socially. It improves health and wellness and helps environmental preservation. Local zoning regulation allows communities to plan for the use of land transparently. Land use decisions involve residents through public hearings and public testimony, and that is very important, and it's a very big part of what city councils do. Zoning regulates the kinds of uses for a property, typically residential, commercial, industrial, and agricultural uses. This prevents overlapping and incompatible uses, like having a home built next door to a factory. Cities allow for multiple types of residential zoning, not just single family, but also multifamily, multi-use, which includes residential and commercial and more. And then local land use planning and decision making are essential tools in developing community character and identity. All of our cities are different and they each have unique characters and identities. Some recent land use planning examples in my city of Minnetonka include we updated our ADU ordinance to allow detached accessory dwelling units in R1 areas. Working to diversify the housing stock in our city. We also extended and expanded the Minnetonka affordable housing policy that requires provision of specific numbers of affordable housing units in new multifamily apartment developments. Wrapping up, if this bill was really about providing affordable housing, cities would likely be more supportive of it. Unfortunately, there is little to nothing that addresses affordable housing in this bill. Cities have a bill, House File 2880, that addresses workforce housing issues in greater detail in Greater Minnesota, and preservation of naturally occurring affordable housing and truly affordable housing in the metro area. The legislature should be focused on how best to partner with cities, as they are the ones who understand their communities the best. So thank you so much for your time today. It's an honor and a privilege to testify today, and I wish you all well. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have the city manager from Perham. Again, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for having me this morning. Jonathan Smith, city manager, city of Perham. I'm here today representing the Coalition of Minnesota Cities, Greater Minnesota Cities, excuse me, and the Association of Small Cities. I serve on both as a committee member for Greater Minnesota as well as a board member for the Association of Small Cities. Today, I'm testifying against House File 3256 as it places unnecessary restrictions on local decision-making without addressing the actual housing challenges we face in Greater Minnesota. We oppose this bill because it would greatly restrict some of our city's fundamental powers, the ability to zone and plan for growth in a way that respects the desires of our residents, as well as protecting the environment and our community. For example, many of our cities, including Perham, may require streets that are wider than 32 feet. Because these communities may want more space for things like bike lanes, on-street parking, or places to put snow, for example, this winter. Without our wider streets in Perham, we'd have a complete catastrophe on some of our roadways with parking and the amount of snow that we have piled up on them. So it's become beneficial for us to have those wider streets in certain circumstances. If local communities decide they want these improvements to have wider streets in the right-of-ways, what is the compelling argument to take that decision away from them locally? Secondly, the proposed restrictions on right-of-way width is also problematic, as today's typical 66-foot width allows adequate space for streets, sidewalks, street lighting, and a variety of utilities. The demand for space in right-of-ways by utilities is increasing, not decreasing. As more companies expand broadband access and reducing this corridor would only make it more difficult to install this new infrastructure. Furthermore, mandating accessory dwelling units and duplexes in single-family zone districts may also have the unintended consequences of increasing density, impervious surface, stormwater, and wastewater concerns, specifically in our shoreline districts, which may also contradict with existing state and local policies. Simply put, us smaller, greater Minnesota cities need more housing, and when a developer wants to put new housing in, we do everything we can to help make it happen. If aspects of our ordinances are deterring construction, we can make that adjustment. Cities already have the flexibility through the planned unit development process to lessen lot sizes, reduce road widths, and allow smaller house sizes in areas that make sense. These tools already exist, so a centralized legislative approach is unnecessary. So while the intentions of this bill may have been good, none of these changes will do anything to address affordable housing in Greater Minnesota, but it will absolutely affect us. We would like to work with the legislature on addressing the housing crisis in Greater Minnesota, but let's focus on the real barriers to work for workforce housing. We respectfully request the opposition of this bill. Thank you.
Madam Chair, you're muted.
Sorry. Mr. Bear, if you would identify yourself and proceed. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Bear. I'm the city administrator for the city of Hugo. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss housing at this committee hearing. Appreciate the opportunity and hope to have an ongoing discussion on this topic, as it is important. The main focus of my comments today on this topic will be related to city comprehensive planning and specifically concerning Article 6 related to density. Really appreciate the comments earlier from Lisa Barajas from the Met Council, and I think in general we would agree with those comments. The bill language in Article 6 does include a requirement for a minimum density of 8 units per acre in the metropolitan area. And to emphasize, that is a minimum density. And I'd like to, if I could, Madam Chair, share my screen, because I think it would be best to show an example. And I think we've got an image on the screen now that shows a drawing. And Charlie, if that's your
screen, it's visible.
If that's your screen, Charlie, if you could scroll up a little bit, so that we can see the rest of the map there. No, I'm sorry. Scroll the other way. So what I'm trying to show here is a map of a pending development application. We have a parcel here of about 132 acres of land that is gated residential for a maximum density of 4 units per acre. It's an application, and we expect this land to develop sometime this summer. First, let me say that the city has developed a comprehensive plan. This is an important process in the city of Hugo, and it results in a careful balancing of land use type, land use intensity, environmental protections, and infrastructure. Now, in any development project, obviously infrastructure is needed for that development to occur. And in this case, I'd like you to pay close attention to the two small pipes that are labeled that come from the south, and they say sewer next to those red arrows. Those are the things that are necessary in order for this project to develop. Without those, the land can't develop. Now, in this case, those sewer pipes are connected to a larger sewer system that goes for a long ways to the south and then connects to the Met Council system. This just happens to be the last property at the end of those sewer pipes. So, in other words, those pipes are just about full. And when the city created its comprehensive plan, it guided this land for a maximum density of 4 units per acre. And that is the maximum that the property can handle. Okay, 8 units per acre is not achievable here because the infrastructure doesn't exist. In other words, we need to tear out the pipes to the south and rebuild new pipes in order to get the sewer pipes to this project. So the application from the development, from the developer, is to develop this land not at the maximum of 4 units per acre, but at about 2.5 units per acre. And that's interesting because there's development challenges here. When you look at development of this property or any property in the city of Hugo, this is really typical. This property is burdened with wetlands and floodplains and stormwater management regulations. There's high groundwater here. You can see the lake off to the right-hand side of the map. And then going through the middle of the property is an agricultural ditch. And this is just typical for the city of Hugo. Something to point out in particular is the dashed blue line on that map is representative of the state shoreland regulations. So that is a line that is drawn 1,000 feet from the edge of Onika Lake. And here's an example where the state rules will require a minimum lot size of 40,000 square feet within that area. So think about that. That's 1 acre lots. And that is a minimum. So think of a minimum density required by the state of 1 unit per acre in that large area of this project. So when we talk about development of land in the city of Hugo, this is what we end up with. Now back to that agricultural ditch. You can see that on going through the middle of the property. We're lucky in this case because that ditch is not subject to shoreland rules. There's a lot of these kind of ditches in Hugo, and most of them are subject to the same shoreland rules, which also affect lot sizes and density. Now, we'd rather not divide the lakeshore of Onika Lake into one-acre lots. Think about manicured lawns and development of lakeshore and docks out into the lake. We'd like to pull those lots back from the edge of the lake and be responsible in development. And the way that we do that is through the use of a planned unit development, through a PUD. In that way, with creativity and innovation, we can get exceptions to those minimum lot size rules. And we can increase the density if we treat the lakeshore properly. And that's what we will hope to do with the developer in this case. Okay, so interesting, let's talk about PUDs. They are intended to allow for innovation and creativity where strict application of the rules don't make sense. Classic example with this project. And Charlie, if you can go down to the next page, maybe we can see that. It includes 55-foot wide lots, 28-foot wide streets. And it's interesting, a lot of the things that are included in the bill are things that we already encourage in the city of Hugo, and we're very accepting of density here. We've been experimenting with a lot of these ideas with PUDs all over the city of Hugo. We take our city council and our planning commissioners and others on a development tour each year to review the results of what we've accomplished. And sometimes that results in changes to our development ordinances if we like the results, or maybe sometimes we don't like the results. And what I'll tell you about some of these ideas is that the results are not normally what we expect. Instead of affordable homes on 55-foot wide lots, what we see is very large homes that are very close together and now exist on very small lots. So smaller lots, in our experience, does not equal affordable homes. So as I say, we are not opposed to density in Hugo, but 8 units per acre is a density that would allow for back-to-back townhomes. A lot of those were built in Hugo about 15 years ago. Townhomes were everywhere. That's what the market wanted at that time. That does not seem to be what the market wants at this time, because we have lots of land in Hugo that's guided for 6 to 8 units per acre and would allow for townhomes. And we're just not seeing a lot of that. The market isn't asking for that at this time. What the market is asking for is a very large single family and very expensive homes. I'd suggest that 8 units per acre minimum would put an end to new single family construction in the metro. There would be no new single family neighborhoods. You can't build them at 8 units per acre. Those neighborhoods would still happen, but they would move to the metro edge where they would be allowed outside of the metro area. So back to this property.
Sir, can you begin to wrap up, please?
Yep, just about done here. If we could figure out how to get the infrastructure here for 8 units per acre, we might eventually get a higher density development. But I would not expect the market to provide low-cost housing here. It'd be more likely that we would find luxury apartments or condominiums here. So density and affordability are not necessarily connected. And I would simply wrap up by suggesting that we need to be really careful before jumping into zoning and comprehensive planning. We as cities are pretty good at this, and we do a good job guiding land use. And density is not going to be appropriate everywhere in each of our communities. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Next, we have the city manager from Prior Lake.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Jason Woodell, and I'm the city manager for the city of Prior Lake. The city of Prior Lake is a growing community of 28,000 residents on our way to becoming 40,000 over the next 20 years. I would like to thank Representative Elkins for listening to cities and including a provision in this bill for street infrastructure fees in Article 1. This is a fee that cities had been collecting for over 3 decades prior to the Harstad versus Woodbury case. Street infrastructure fees are a critical funding source for building the necessary expansion of our street networks that are needed solely to accommodate new growth and development. Without this fee, the cost of growth is placed on the backs of our existing taxpayers. Unfortunately, the language that is included in HF 3256 is extremely problematic. Having personally lived and worked in the housing industry during the past recession in 2008, the time limits that are included in this bill for the use of the funds just will not work. Cities do not control the rate or pace of growth. As the rate of growth slows, as it has done many times in the past, the capital improvements detailed in our comprehensive plans are also delayed. House File 3256 makes no accommodation for this reality. This clawback provision will shift the costs of growth from new development onto the backs of our existing taxpayers. We need to protect our naturally occurring affordable housing. This article would do precisely the opposite, shifting the cost of growth to the property taxes of existing residents. This bill also includes language pertaining to our impact fees for water and sanitary sewer, stormwater, and park dedication fees. Cities already have statutory authority to collect these fees, and any modification to our existing authority would only serve to transfer risk and cost from new development onto our existing taxpayers. In Prior Lake, we seek to preserve the affordable housing we have and encourage more affordable housing. We have worked with our developers and home builders to approve new subdivisions with small lots and increased density, but affordable homes are not being built. If you look in the Parade of Homes catalog that just came out this week, the Parade of Homes starts on March 12th. There are 8 homes in the upcoming Parade of Homes in Prior Lake. Of those homes, 7 of the 8 are in subdivisions with small lots. The lowest price point home of that group is $580,000, and the range goes all the way up to $1.3 million. The builder of the $1.3 million model has 23 lots in his subdivision and a 700-person waiting list for those 23 lots, with the lowest priced home starting at $1 million. As a city, we do not receive requests from developers asking for help from the city to build entry-level homes because they continue to be very successful at selling homes at this upper price point. We need to focus on proactive measures that can truly have an impact on housing affordability. And that includes down payment assistance for first-time home buyers and more funding for community land trusts. If subsidy and reduced risk is to be applied, it should go to the entry-level home buyer, not to the for-profit developers. Nothing in this bill would guarantee reductions in the sales price of housing. Focusing on partnerships between the state and local municipalities on these things would. There are more comments that I could provide, but in the interest of time, I will end here. Prior Lake is unique due to our topography and having a large recreational lake in the middle of our city. This dramatically impacts our utility infrastructure, as well as our street network as compared to our sister cities. Other cities have their own unique characteristics that you've heard from today that impact how they develop. The approach to housing and new development, therefore, must also be unique to each community. The cities of Scott County did send a 7-page letter to Representative Elkins on February 18th that provides more detail on the concerns we have with each of the 12 articles within this bill, and I would be happy to provide a copy of our comments to this committee if you are interested. Thank you for having me before you this morning, and I would be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you very much. And next, we have Mr. Thompson from Plymouth. Again, please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair Mason and committee members. My name is Michael Thompson. I'm the Public Works Director for the City of Plymouth. Today, I'm representing the City Engineers Association of Minnesota as its recent president. We're a statewide association of municipal engineers that design, operate, and maintain city roads, bridges, and utilities. I'm also speaking on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities. I will keep my comments brief. I wanted to touch on 3 items. First, Article 1 authorizes cities to charge street impact fees, which we support. It is important to ensure that development pays for development-related infrastructure instead of existing taxpayers paying for new development. However, SEEM and the League do prefer the language in Representative Mason's House File 527 bill, which was drafted with input from multiple stakeholders last year. Second item, Article 2 contains authority for cities to implement street improvement districts. SEEM and the League have long sought this authority, and we appreciate Representative Elkins including this in his bill, which would provide a funding mechanism that is equitable, is based on actual traffic data and usage, holds cities accountable to a public process, and is fair in the distribution of its costs. It ensures those users that pay fees receive the benefit of the investment of the street maintenance within an established district. It does not prohibit cities from collecting fees for most tax-exempt properties within a district, some of which can be significant traffic generators. The bottom line is, if the users of streets don't pay for repairs, then the taxpayers, many times homeowners, carry the burden of those that don't pay into the system. Finally, we appreciate the amendment Representative Elkins made to clarify the language around the 32-foot local residential street requirement in Article 5. While the amendment improves the provision to allow space beyond a 32-foot wide paved street to accommodate associated utilities and sidewalks, Jonathan Smith from PIRM also touched on this. There are other items. It fails to address space for stormwater features, snow storage, future sidewalk connections, if not part of current construction, and tree plantings is just a few examples, which undoubtedly vary from community to community. We look forward to continuing the conversation and support safety on all of our local streets. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you so much. And that, I believe, is the last testifier we have on 3256. Am I missing anything, buddy? Okay. We have time to take a few questions right now, but I want to make sure that at 9:30 we can go to Representative Pulaski's bill. I think I saw Representative Elkins hand up first. Proceed. Representative
Madam Chair, if Representative Quam has a quick question, because I'm going to have a bunch of questions.
Okay, Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, I will follow the author in case he answers some of the things that I'm curious about. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Mr. Representative Elkins, proceed.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So just, you know, going through some of the comments, you know, I represent parts of Minnetonka, and in fact, the part of Minnetonka that I represent is largely multifamily housing. Particularly, I've enjoyed representing an area of Minnetonka called the Beaches, because all the streets are named after beaches in Florida, which is a fairly dense townhouse complex. And so if you're door knocking, you can knock on about 250 doors in one day if you hustle. So I appreciate the fact that that Minnetonka, you know, has been pursuing very progressive policies in terms of adding new affordable housing, whether it's the ADUs or the transit-oriented housing that they're putting near their light rail stations. And I would like to add also that I do think that a truly comprehensive solution to the housing problem will include both funding for affordable housing initiatives to build and preserve affordable housing. And so I am also a co-author on the League's bill, House File 2880, that Chair Houseman is carrying. And with respect to Mr. Smith's testimony, I have been speaking with representatives of the League of the Greater Minnesota Cities and the Small Cities. And I want everyone to recognize that I do understand that the problems faced by small cities in Greater Minnesota are very different from the problems that we face in Minnesota, in the Twin Cities, I'm sorry. They have a problem where land isn't an issue at all like it is in the Twin Cities. And the bigger problem they face is that it's hard to get homes built because it costs more to build them than they're worth once they're constructed. So I think in Greater Minnesota cities, and I've had this conversation with them, that the technology is going to be a big part of the solution. In a lot of Greater Minnesota cities already manufactured housing, which is largely being manufactured in cities in Greater Minnesota, is going to be a bigger part of their solution for both single family and multifamily housing. And then on the comments that he made, and also from Mike Thompson from the engineers, are clarifying the language about the 32 feet, that the 32 foot is only curb to curb. If you look in the state aid manual for a busier two-lane road that's 36 feet, it specifies a right-of-way of 60 feet. I would expect that on a 32-foot wide street, the right-of-way would probably end up at around 55 feet, which is plenty of room to put, you know, boulevard trees, sidewalks, stormwater utilities, you name it. But the scholarship on street widths is very clear that when you build streets at 36 foot wide, you encourage speeding. They're less safe. And I would note that the city of Plymouth itself was a very early adopter of a policy of narrower streets with sidewalks in their new residential neighborhoods. They've been doing that for over a decade right now. I thought Mr. Bear's testimony was excellent. And I wanted to clarify that with respect to the 8 units per acre, it was my intention is to allow developers to build on an 8 units per acre by right. It's not my intention that a city should develop at 8 units per acre. And if the language around that is ambiguous and that's the way people are interpreting it, I'll go back and look at that and change it, because that's not the intention. I would note that any undevelopable land, such as wetlands, does not count towards that standard in any case, and that the provisions related to ADUs, duplexes, whatnot, there's nothing in the bill that supersedes any of a city's zoning ordinances as they relate to health, safety, or welfare. So anybody building a duplex or an ADU or higher density housing, you still have to meet all of the zoning requirements, like the setbacks, height limitations, whatever, that are there for the purposes of preserving the health, safety, and welfare of the community. There's nothing in the bill that preempts that. I would agree. PUDs is a big point here. And I think certainly in the case of shoreline development that he is describing, where there are unique site characteristics, is in fact a perfectly appropriate use of the plan unit development process. So I've got a bunch of questions for Ms. Gao that I want to ask, because I heard an important concession in what she discussed. Ms. Gao, are you available for a few questions?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, I am.
Okay, so in your testimony, I think I did hear you grant that the zoning and planning authorities which that cities in Minnesota have are granted in state statute, and mostly they're in Chapter 462 with an overlay in Chapter 473 for city-specific requirements that are specific to cities in the metro area. So you'd agree with that, I think.
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, yes, cities are creatures of the state, as you had described in your presentation. And so we do derive our authority from the state.
And so it would be
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, sorry, Madam Chair. Yeah, Madam Chair, Ms. Gao. So wouldn't you agree that it's appropriate for the legislature from time to time to review those authorities while we see that there are issues creeping in and periodically update them?
Madam Chair, you are still muted, but I did see that you had said my name. So, Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, yes, the state's role is to review statutes from time to time. And as I also had testified, zoning is something that is best handled locally for a variety of reasons that you actually just mentioned as well.
Yeah.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So, would you agree with me that the last time the legislature actually conducted a comprehensive review of the zoning statutes was in the 1994-95 timeframe?
Ms. Cow.
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, I actually don't know specifically when that was. That was just a little bit before my time at the legislature. So I am not sure when the comprehensive look at zoning happened for the state.
Okay, so
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in the 1994-1995 round of changes is where the Livable Communities Program was established. It's when when the state legislature finally resolved the comp plan zoning issue with firmly stating that henceforth in state law, where there are conflicts between the comp plan and the zoning, the comp plan would rule. And would you at least agree that under current state law, where there are conflicts between the zoning and the comp plan rules?
Ms. Cow.
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, I think you might be starting to creep into an area where the League is not an expert if you're talking about specifically issues related to metro area cities or 473. I would defer to my colleague, Charlie Vander Aarde, or those who are in metro cities. Comprehensive plans, you are correct, and Mr. Baer talked a little bit about this, that comprehensive plans are a visioning for what is in the future. And to the extent, and there are cities throughout the state that use comprehensive plans, they are working their way to that to address issues of growth that then encompass things, not just residential development, but infrastructure as well as commercial and industrial uses throughout their entire city.
Madam
Representative Elkins.
Madam Chair, Ms. Gao, where in the statute does it characterize the comprehensive plan as a long-range plan, a future plan, and not the plan for what comes next?
Ms. Gao.
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, I am maybe not sure what you're asking. My understanding is that it is what comes next, both in the immediate future as well as what's going to be not just tomorrow, next year, but into the future as well. Where is that in statute? I don't have the statute pulled up in front of me. You are, I think what you're trying to get at, correct me if I'm wrong, is that there are zoning ordinances are meant to get to that place of meeting where the comprehensive plan is. Zoning districts are not always immediately zoned now for what that future development is going to be, and that there is an issue in terms of, you and I have had these conversations in terms of phased development. And that's part of the reason, and you've talked about this as well, even in the previous hearing, is what's complicated about all of this is then how do you ensure that the infrastructure supports the development that is upcoming?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Elkins.
Yes, I agree that we are engaged in continuing conversations with the stakeholders, including the League, about what should the nature of the, what I refer to sometimes as the temporal nature of zoning and planning be. Right now we have the comp plan, we have the zoning, we have the capital improvement program, but I can't find anywhere in state statute where the timing of what's referred to as stage in the orderly development is addressed right now. But I don't see anything in current state law that supports the general notion that seems to be widespread that the comp plan doesn't govern what's happening today, because work that was done by Met Council researchers basically said that what gets built today is going to be there for the rest of our lifetimes. Typical commercial use is there for 30 to 50 years, and in the case of housing patterns, they're basically permanent; they never change. So the decisions that we make today about land use are going to be inherited by our forebears for generations into the future. So, given I think we're in agreement that there is a requirement, especially in the metro, that zoning be conformed to the comp plan. And within the metro, it's explicit in statute that zoning has to be conformed to the comp plan within 9 months of adopting a change to the comp plan. Do you have an opinion about what does it mean for zoning to be conforming to the comp plan?
Madam Chair?
I see Representative Quam, and I wanted to finish this by 9:30.
Yeah, I'll wrap this up in a second. I have a few more questions.
I would like to get Representative Quam on shortly. So, okay, if you can, I'll give you another minute, and then we'll go.
Yep.
To Representative Plum.
Yeah, so in the bill, I'm attempting to provide a definition for the first time for what it means for zoning to be conforming to planning, because I don't see anything in the current statutes that provide such a definition. So would you think that there's some kind of a common agreed sense of what that means? Because I don't. So the question is, you know, what would an appropriate definition be for when the zoning is conforming to the comp plan?
Ms. Cao, can you give a quick answer, and then we'll go to Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, I am not sure if I can give a quick answer. I'm not sure how to address that. I think that part of the problem or the complexity of these conversations is that there is a lot of depth to that. What I can offer is an example of why sometimes zoning doesn't conform with a comp plan. For example, if you have land that is zoned agricultural for future residential development, that's not going to be your zoning ordinances. That zoning district is not going to be residential right now. And so thus that temporal nature, thus the stage development, and that's why that doesn't work. How do you get at that? I do think involves all of the stakeholders that are at the table and part of these discussions today and last week.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the previous few minutes indicate just why this isn't ready for moving on. I would like to bring out most of the state is not in the Met Council. And we should be I thought we were doing legislation for affordable housing for the state of Minnesota, and it seems as if we're overemphasizing part of the state and certain peculiarities about having a non-elected council running the so much of what the local cities who are run by elected people should be doing. When I look at the affordable housing in the bill, there's a lot of great intent, but it's always difficult when we get down to the actual specifics and working out the details. And that's why options and having, some flexibility, but having guide rails, guidelines to help assist in, bringing the sides together. So this is a huge endeavor to take care of in the fashion that the bill is addressing it. Whenever we talk about affordable housing, let us focus back. What do each of these components do to the effective average cost? And I think we can debate that and work on that as bills come forward. But I hope we can try and at least have do a lot of the work out, before it hits committee. And that way we address it with the bill and amendments. And then we also can focus on, specific, having the right people to answer those specific questions. And that way we can proceed, more in motion of, in an orderly fashion. But I look forward to seeing this come forward once some of these details are worked out in future committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. This bill is going to be laid over. Representative Elkins is continuing to work on that. But Representative Elkins, I'll give you 1 minute if you want to add something to that.
To wrap up, I think we've established this morning that it is appropriate for the state legislature to periodically review the statutes that govern planning and zoning in the state periodically. It hasn't been done in 25 years, and so I'm aware that the conversation that I've started involves a very complicated subject, and I'm committed to continuing to work with all of the stakeholders to evolve, and will not be requesting a real hearing, quote unquote, on this bill until we have more of these issues worked out. But we have a situation in the state right now, and it's especially in the metro, but I'm not ignoring the problems that are unique to greater Minnesota as well. where we have the most, you know, segregated living patterns in the country, where there are gross disparities in how home ownership by race, and where it's not just a racial equity issue, it's a generational equity issue. I've got millennial children that are in their mid-30s who still haven't been able to afford their first home. And, you know, report after report, whether it's the AI Task Group or the Urban Land Institute or the previous governor's Blue Ribbon Council on Housing, are all identifying this huge missing middle of the housing market that is not being satisfied right now. And in every single one of those reports, zoning reform is called out as a significant barrier that needs to be overcome. And that's what I'm trying to accomplish here. So it's great. You know, I fully support House File 2880, which provides, you know, would provide lots of money to, you know, to provide gap funding to build affordable housing that cannot be built profitably by the private market. But it doesn't matter how much money we appropriate for affordable housing if city zoning ordinances won't allow it to be built. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and thank you, everyone, for the intense discussion. And for those of you who are watching our committee for the first time, if you go back to our February 23rd meeting, that's when the presentation and other testimony is there as well. So thank you very much. And at this point, I would like to move on. The next bill for consideration is House File 3682. The bill was referred to this committee from by the chair of the State Government Finance and Elections Committee. And I definitely would like us to be voting on this by 9:55. I will move that House File 3682 be recommended to be referred to the State Government Finance and Elections Committee. Representative Pulaski, welcome to our committee, and to your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 3682 is a revision and modernization of Chapter 331A. 331A is the chapter that governs the basic rules for publication of public notices. It's been 30 years since we've revised this, and there has been something called the digital revolution over the last 30 years that has changed the newspaper industry. So what this bill does, it synchronizes the distribution in both print and digital formats of public notices, and it ensures that a public notice disseminated in a digital format is a valid form of communication. It's a bill that was worked on by the Minnesota Newspaper Association with the local units of government. I don't think there is any opposition to the bill. Mark Amundson is here today as a representative of the Minnesota Newspaper Association. I think he may want to say a few words, Madam Chair, but basically that's the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Amundson, if you would like to identify yourself for the record and proceed, please, and welcome to the committee. Are you there, I hope?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Amundson? Oh, I see you. Okay, you are unmuted.
Madam Chair, do you hear me now?
We do hear you. Thank you.
You know, I'm one of those people who has not participated in your committee before that you just referred to, so I'm off to a bad start this morning. I apologize. My link wasn't live. So good morning, members, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Anthonson. I'm the attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. I've had a hand in drafting this bill, of course. And I'm just going to briefly add a little bit to what Representative Pulaski said, but not belabor it, and happy to answer any questions the members have, of course. The focus of the bill is on the dissemination of public notices. It doesn't add any new public notices to state law, and it doesn't change any current notices, with one small exception. The bill's provisions would basically update and modernize some of the rules that govern how public notices are disseminated that appear currently in Chapter 331A. The current structure of the statute of Chapter 331A requires that a newspaper in which public notices appear must have some nexus, some geographical nexus to who's publishing the notice. And that, of course, makes good sense. You want the notice to be seen by the people it affects. But the criteria used in the statute for determining what that nexus is have become very clunky and outmoded because of mainly because of changes in the newspaper industry, which Representative Pawlowski referred to. So by proposing the new definitions and rules regarding the location of the newspaper and where notices can appear, the bill would make it considerably easier for government bodies and others to properly publish public notices. That's the goal, to make the process more efficient and easier to use. The bill, as it stands before you today, was originally prompted by a call that I received from the MSBA, the School Boards Association, about a year and a half ago. And they asked us if we'd be interested in working together to update the statute. Seemed like a good idea. Since then, we've discussed the provisions of the bill with representatives of most of the groups that represent local public bodies in the state. And as Representative Pawlowski indicated, there seems to be general agreement that the bill, if it's enacted, would significantly improve current law. Now, I'm not going to touch on each section of the bill unless the chair wants me to. The summary prepared by House Research is very good on this bill. It touches on each of the provisions and describes them, I think, very accurately. So I'll let you look at that if that's okay, Madam Chair. But I will be happy to answer at any level of detail the committee wants me to, any questions that the members might have this morning. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, are there any questions? Right now, I'm not seeing any. Okay, I will wait for one more minute. Okay, I am not seeing any questions from, okay, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't sure exactly how long the different testimony would be. The one curiosity is when people look at, you know, the electronic versions have to be accessible. I would like that they don't count towards your free 2, 3, or 5 that are allowed. And that way, and I could talk to the author about this specific thing. But otherwise, I like the intent and the effort. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Pawlowski, do you want to respond?
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, it would be my intention that it not do that. We've had that debate before during the Great Recession, so I'm familiar with it, and I agree with you.
Okay, good. Representative Quam?
That took care of it, and I'll work with the author as needed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Again, I am not seeing any other hands. Chair Pawlowski, any closing comments?
Madam Chair, I just picked up the Winona Post, which is the weekly paper today. I picked up the Winona Daily News, which is our daily paper in paper form, and I can log on to both if I so desire. So this bill is needed to make sure that both of those formats work for us no matter what's in the paper.
Thank you very much. I will renew my motion that House File 3682 be recommended to be re-referred back to the State Government Finance and Elections Committee. And Josh, if you would take the roll, please.
Representative Mason.
Mason, aye.
Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Representative Quam?
Aye.
Representative Berg?
Aye.
Representative Bolden?
Bolden, aye.
Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Mecklen?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Joachim?
Aye.
We have 9 ayes.
Okay. So the motion prevails. Representative Pulaski, you're on your way. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
The last thing I would like to do is the minutes from our last meeting from February 23rd. Representative Quam, have you read the minutes?
I would so move approval.
Thank you. Are there any additions or corrections? Okay, hearing no discussion, all those in favor, again, unmute and say aye, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. Okay, the motion or the minutes stand approved as written. Thank you so very much. Before we adjourn, are there any comments? If not, we will stand adjourned. Thank you, everyone. Have a good day.